Welcome to the Corlin Economics Report, a weekly look at financial and political topics relating to asset-based investing. Guests on this program pay no fees to appear, and guests and hosts disclose any equity interest in companies profiled. Now, the Corlin Economics Report.
Hey, everyone. Welcome in to the weekend edition of the KE Report. Corey and Chad here, your hosts on this weekend's edition, also your hosts throughout the week on our website, kereport.com, and podcast, The KE Report. You can also check us out on some of our social media channels and on YouTube. Just search The KE Report. We're kicking off this weekend's show with Mike Larson, editor-in-chief at Money Show. And Mike, just a broad comment here. We will get into individual sectors, but look, Money Show is really focused on a wide range of markets. You bring in a lot of traders, you bring in a lot of market commentators, and let them take the floor, share their thoughts with where they think markets are going and what will be the outperforming sectors. Can you summarize what you've been hearing from some of the guests you like? And also, in all fairness, your calls on the market, which have played the downside, the bear market a couple years ago, and that rebound bull market that we've seen. What are people at the Money Show most interested in?
Yeah, I think, you know, in this market environment, I mean, it's interesting is growth tech, that whole part of the market, it doesn't just have great stories to it, great narratives, things like, you know, AI and all the ways it can change business and consumer operations and things like that. It also happens to have market performance. If you want to find something that's catnip for investors, it's a great story and great performance. And that's what we've seen in tech overall. And then some subsectors of tech, sub areas like AI related stocks and so on. So clearly people are interested in that. They're making money in that and they want to know how to make more money in that. That being said, I think that, you know, there's something to be said for some of these sleepier sectors and you know, people looking at this being a year where, yes, tech is still going to perform solidly, but there are other places that you're going to be able to make money. And I think some of the things that have not performed as well, but that could play catch up, let's call it things like financials, let's call it things like small caps. I think people want to look, you know, for other alternatives. I mean, it's great making money in one sector that had a phenomenal 2023 and that will probably have a pretty solid 2024. But people are also looking elsewhere. And, you know, I think one of the big stories out there is, hey, if this is a market where we dodge a recession, which is what the numbers seem to be suggesting, and not only that, we get the soft landing, which is something that, you know, the Fed has tried to stick many, many times and probably hasn't effectively done so in about 30 years since the mid-1990s. If you get that scenario, then that is pretty darn bullish for small caps and other, you know, sort of domestically growth levered type sectors. And by growth, I mean economic growth, not growth as in big tech growth. So long story short, I think that, you know, this is going to be a year again where people are generally optimistic, not wildly optimistic, but generally optimistic and want to know about some other things, maybe outside of tech, as much as they're still interested there. I would add that the crypto space, cryptocurrencies are, you know, we're starting to get some nibbles and some interest there. That's been a sector that obviously has had so many sort of boom bust cycles over the last 5, 6, 7 years. But this time with the sort of mainstreaming of the sector, all the money coming in, the new Bitcoin ETFs getting approval and what that's likely to have an impact in terms of institutionalization of a sector that has, you know, been at the fringes of the finance world, that has a lot of people excited. So I think that's another thing that people are interested in, and I think probably rationally so.
Well, Mike, let's tug on a few of those strings as far as these individual sectors outside of tech. Obviously, everybody can see the outperformance of tech over the last year or so and the excitement around AI, but you mentioned the small caps there, and I'm thinking back to the fourth quarter of last year where we saw the markets kind of bottom in October and then rip higher, and everything was ripping higher across the board. But some of those small caps in the Russell 2000 really took off. And now some of them have corrected down a little bit here just to start the year after quite a rally. Maybe they were getting a little bit overbought. But you had made the point of some research you looked at that showed other market cycles and how often the small caps underperform right before they really outperform. Maybe unpack that a little bit further for listeners here.
Yeah, sure. I mean, there's some great data. I think it was Charlie Biello who put it together. I follow him on Twitter or X or whatever we're calling it these days. But some of the work being done there, and it sort of put to bed the narrative that, well, you can't have a lasting market rally if small caps, if it's not a little broader, if some of those stocks being left behind don't participate. He looked at some of the data, and I think it was pretty convincing. And the narrative kind of shifted to, well, You can have that where big cap and big tech or big cap is running and some other stocks have been left behind. But typically, that condition is solved by other stocks playing catch up, and not just catch up, but overtaking the big runners. So in other words, you can, is a glass half full or glass half empty when you look at a market that doesn't have as much participation as you want. His argument was, again, that you're going to see this situation resolved not by like big tech crashing and small cap continuing to dramatically underperform, but rather big tech and the big cap part of the market doing okay, but the small cap side of the market picking up the baton and running, particularly over the course of the next 12 to sort of 15 months. And I think that sounds pretty valid to me. I mean, you know, when I think about sort of conceptually what type of environment is great for, again, domestic growth, sort of your smaller mid-cap type names, it's a situation where everybody's priced for a recession or a hard landing. You don't get it. So then you get some more of the growth component there that, hey, maybe these guys are going to be tied to a little bit of a rebound in the economy, or at least just a softening and stabilization versus a recession. And oh, by the way, now you don't have the interest rate situation hanging over them. And some of the other things that were holding back the sector, particularly financials being a kind of a key component in that, in the smaller cap or mid cap space, you remove these worries about this mass wave of bank failures, which is obviously what we were all dealing with a year ago at this time. You remove that, and then, hey, what kind of environment is it? It's pretty bullish. So I think that's what you're going to see, is you're going to see some rotation. You're going to see some broadening out. You're going to see a market that, you know, we did run in small caps in November and December. We corrected in the back half of December and most of this month, but I think we're starting to kind of tentatively find our feet there again. And I think that's a pretty attractive part of the market for this year. So I would, you know, I think that after avoiding that or people staying away from that sector, it's going to behoove you to start paying more attention and getting more into small and mids this year.
Mike, what do you take away from some of these market commentators, some of which that look simply just at markets, a wide range of markets and how they are moving, sometimes individually, sometimes in relation to each other? And then these other market commentators that try to be economists and dissect every different economic data point that come out and then carry that into the markets to make their market calls. What do you think truly drives markets?
Look, I think it's a mix of sentiment. It's a mix of positioning. It's a mix of economics. It's a mix of the cost of money. And, you know, on almost every front, things just don't look all that bad to me. I mean, on, you know, the cost of money front, the Fed is going to be cutting this year. You can argue about whether it's going to be 3, 4, 5, 6. I mean, the markets are all over the place sort of trading that scenario. But we're certainly not in a situation where the Fed's going to be hiking rates, and they're probably not even just going to be sitting on them. So from a monetary standpoint, you've got a tailwind. An economic standpoint, let's be honest, this is waiting for this recession. It's like you've got to, you know, you're like Rip Van Winkle. You could probably fall asleep against a tree and wake up in 100 years and still be looking for it. You know, the recession hasn't come. If we made it through the bank failures, if we made it through basically this cycle's dot-com bust, which we had a couple years ago with all the SPACs blowing up and all the, you know, profitless tech companies going bankrupt and so on, we made it through that and we don't have a recession. You've got that going for you from an economic standpoint. You do have, again, from a sentiment standpoint, even now, I don't see indicators suggesting that we're wildly bullish. You know, and it's not just the people on X or on the internet that will never be bullish till, you know, kingdom come, but it's also just from a positioning standpoint. I mean, the data is leaning bullish, but it certainly doesn't look toppy. It certainly doesn't look like the wild, you know, crazy exuberance you see at the end of 1999 or anything like that. So from a sentiment standpoint, I think you still have a kind of a decent bullish tailwind. So, I mean, you throw together sentiment, economics, cost of money, all that, policy basis, it looks like a pretty bullish environment. I mean, you know, who knows what's going to happen with the election? There's still some other things that can happen. There's geopolitics. I mean, God forbid what's happening in the Middle East, spreads, and so on and so forth. Taiwan and China getting in a shooting war, whatever. But outside of those things, I think, you know, it's a pretty constructive environment. So I would say, you know, my advice for investors is don't go looking for a, you know, horribly negative story when there just isn't one. I don't think that's being Pollyanna-ish or whatever. I think it's just being rational. There's times, and you guys, I've been talking to you guys for a long, long time. There's times when I am really pretty bearish, but I just don't see a reason to be now, and I haven't seen one for the last year.
Yeah, some great points there, Mike. And some people are just defaulted to always being uber bearish or uber bullish on either side of the equation. But one thing that has a lot of people's attention over the last year has been the movement of so much money into money markets on the sidelines, because for the first time in over a decade, people could actually make some yield on their money in a safer money market or CD or some kind of a vehicle without so much risk to the markets. And a lot of people patted themselves on the back the second half of last year for doing that and making 4 or 5%, maybe even 5.5% on their money. But then they watched the markets take off and do double digit gains in the fourth quarter and maybe didn't feel as great about that decision. If we do start seeing the Fed cut rates and if we see interest rates continue to pull back down, then some of those yields maybe won't be as attractive as they were last year. Do you think that that means some of that money comes back in and starts speculating again in the markets?
Yeah, I mean, I think anytime you lower the cost of money and you lower the risk-free rate, you know, the yield that people are picking up on just sort of their spare cash, I mean, you are going to be looking, it is going to drive some subset of the money that's parked basically to look for a home that's going to treat it better. You know, we're not, and I would say we're not going to be in that sort of TINA, ZERP, NERP, you know, everything's negative. So gosh, I have to chase every lousy garbage stock out there to find some yield and return, which is what helped fuel the SPAC and profitless.com bubble. We're not in that environment. We're in an environment where yields are probably going to come down. They're not going to collapse. So again, I would argue that that's modestly bullish. That's an environment where some money is going to look for a better home, but you don't have to be, you know, a 90-year-old retiree who goes, oh, you know, only has a couple of years left that's going to throw all their money into SPACs because they're earning zero or negative returns. You know, that's crazy. That's ridiculous. You don't want that. But an environment where rates might come down from 5-ish% gently to 4-ish%, or maybe the high or mid threes, is going to create modest fuel for markets. And I think, again, that's probably bullish.
All right, let's get into a couple of specific markets. The first one being Bitcoin. Look, we recently had some Bitcoin ETF approvals. You even mentioned how still the environment at some money shows is simply that people are seemingly still very interested in the crypto space. However, ETFs were approved. Bitcoin has gone down since. What's your outlook on Bitcoin now that ETFs are in the mix?
Sure. I think what you're going to see and what you already are seeing is an institutionalizing to a degree of a market that's lived on sort of the fringes of the financial markets world, right? I mean, you know, when Bitcoin first came out, there's probably 5 or 10 people standing around talking about it. And if, you know, you asked your average retiree on the street, what was Bitcoin? They'd look at you like that you were crazy, you know, 10, 15 years ago. More recently, you've had this sort of boom bust cycle. We've had, you know, still a lot of individual speculation, lack of sort of structure and institutionalization in the market. So you've had these wild, you know, quadrupling, quintupling of markets, then 80% plunges and so on and so forth. But now with ETFs getting involved, with futures being involved, with more, you know, advisors and family offices and, you know, endowments and things like that, that will say, okay, this is a burgeoning asset class that is not going to take 20% of somebody's money, but a percent, 2, 3, 4, who knows exactly what it's going to be. You're gradually going to see money move into this market and you're going to see more stabilization and more acceptance. Because I think it's too big of a trend to go away. I think there are some use cases out there. Yeah, I kind of look at it as, you know, just like the housing sector in the mid-2000s, which got wildly overinflated, huge boom, huge crash. You know, a lot of builders went bankrupt, mortgage lenders went bankrupt, people lost billions, blah, blah, blah. But out of that, you know, whatever, that wipeout, there were a couple of companies that survived. There were some rational lenders that survived. People gradually started getting back into houses because they made sense on terms of, you know, buying a house versus renting or price of a house, multiple to income, things like that. So the industry ultimately came out of that. Same thing with the dot-coms, you know, I mean, why is Amazon such a Goliath today? Because it survived the boom bust in that market, even as many of its competitors got wiped out. So I sort of look at crypto as being the same thing. It had a gigantic, enormous bubble, a huge, gigantic crash, and, you know, all these people going to jail and all these, you know, bad actors getting shoved out and companies going broke and so on. But you're left with an asset class that does serve some purpose. Investors that are going to step in if they know that there's some guardrails around this market. And that's what I think you're seeing. So I think that's why, again, boom, bust, and then, you know, you pick through the ashes and see what's left. That's where I think we are in the crypto space. And that's why I think people are starting to pay attention again.
Well, Mike, I know you also follow the precious metal sector, and a lot of our listeners do as well. When you look at gold, really since before U.S. Thanksgiving last year and since then, it's been waffling around either side of 2000, but mostly held above it now for, you know, November, December, into January. Not a lot of life in the gold stocks, though. Those are still kind of in the hurt locker, but a lot of people are waiting for the proverbial breakout in gold. Do you see that happening in 2024? Do you see us waffling sideways here in limbo forever? Or is there a risk of a pullback in the precious metal sector?
No, I mean, I think, you know, we've gone up, we've tagged that breakout level. And unlike in past times when we've quickly kind of failed, you know, right now we seem to be consolidating rather than failing. So I'm pretty optimistic there. I mean, admittedly, this is kind of somebody who's been pretty optimistic for a while and it hasn't panned out to a true breakout. But I think I'm pretty optimistic there. I think that there's a lot of things that argue for gold beyond just technicals. I mean, you've got monetary policy. You've got people looking for other things that, you know, in an environment where the dollar is not going up every month like it did last year for most of the year and so on. Things that argue for strength there. So, you know, I think it's still an area you want to lean bullishly. I mean, obviously, it'd be great for people who've been patient to get that breakout. It's hard to say, don't worry, this time it's really going to happen. But I think, okay, I'm going to say it, this time it's really going to happen. So there you have it. I think that, again, because you've got some tailwinds in the form of policy, you've got some tailwinds in the form of the cost of money, currency, and so on that argue for a better environment. So patience is annoying sometimes, but sometimes it's also the best choice as an investor.
So then does that gold price breakout finally drive the stocks, carry the stocks with it?
Yeah, I mean, I think it has to, right? I mean, anytime you're a commodity or metals producer and your underlying market does well, it arguably should be bullish for the sector overall. I mean, there's going to be bad players. There's going to be companies that get caught. There's going to be companies that, you know, have operational issues and so on that are going to cause problems. But I mean, in a bullish macro backdrop kind of environment, ultimately it's good for the sector. So yeah, I would think that you're going to see better times ahead.
Well, Mike, what about the energy space? Oil and nat gas are always a wild ride. 2022, they were a breakout story. 2023, they were a pullback story. How's 2024 setting up for the energy space?
Yeah, it's interesting. I actually just had a conversation with a guy who's a pretty big analyst in that sector. We're going to be releasing the episode soon. His take was, he kind of talked about the clean energy transition, you know, how it's more of an evolution versus revolution, how there's going to be a lot of demand for traditional oil and gas and, you know, need for things like what the oil services companies are doing, especially internationally for a long, long time. Kind of talked about the idea of going from, you know, much of the world that still has sort of needs to go to an energy abundant environment from being sort of energy strapped. So all of that adds up to a generally bullish long-term thesis. So, you know, I think that, again, that sector had a great 2022. 2023 wasn't anything impressive. I would call myself as modestly bullish there, and I think that's probably a good stance for investors to have, too.
What about copper then, too? Because, boy, oh, boy, I hear a lot of bullish comments about copper, the supply-demand imbalance, why copper needs to be much higher just for new builds to happen. But copper also does tie into the economy, and with a bit of a better outlook for the economy, even though a lot of people still waiting for that recession, is this year the year that copper finally has its day to shine and truly break out?
You know, again, maybe modestly bullish. I think the problem with a lot of the base metals is that it, you know, money that's not sort of sector focused specific is going to look at it as just a China play, right? And they're going to look at Chinese headlines and they're going to say, Chinese economy still stinks. The Chinese stock market's at a 5-year low. They're having to throw hundreds of billions of dollars more at their real estate and stock market because of all the issues they're having there with lenders going broke and nobody wanting to build these, you know, buy these ghost cities and so on. And that's just my issue with some of the, they're just sort of, you know, whether it's proper or not, that is kind of the perception. And when perception rules, sometimes actual money follows. And I think that's why some of those base metals are just going to have a hard time getting much momentum. Even if the U.S. economy were to do very well, you'd need to see it drag China up. And I just don't think that's what we're seeing right now.
Well, Mike, if we widen the scope out internationally, any other markets outside of the U.S. markets that have your attention as potential areas for investors to look at?
Yeah, again, I think so much of the, especially, you know, the Asian sphere and a lot of South America that exports to China and so on is tied to that. There's concerns about the geopolitics there. So I think that you can make a case that some of these markets are undervalued, but they're undervalued for good reasons. I'd like to see just some sort of geopolitical detente with China. I'd like to see some, you know, indications that they're getting a handle on their economic issues. They're maybe going to do a bigger stimulus or something. It would take something like that to really get me to look more at developing and emerging markets. I'd be more inclined to lean towards some of the developed markets, from look overseas, places like Europe and so on. that I think can, kind of get dragged up by U.S. strength and maybe just some, it's a stalemate situation. We worry less about what's happening in Eastern Europe. That would probably be good for those areas. So that's where I'd focus personally.
All right, Mike, we've covered a lot of different sectors. Thank you so much for your insights and sharing some of the insights you get from all of the money shows. That's why I like the shows that you guys put on. It's a wide range of comments, and you can hear bullish, bearish comments on a lot of different sectors, all just playing, whatever direction those markets are going. Thanks again for your time, Mike. We'll chat probably in another few weeks. I hope you have a great rest of your weekend.
Sounds good. Take care, guys.
Al Corlin's firm, A.B. Corlin and Associates Incorporated, provides consulting services to public companies on matters of regulatory compliance. To find out more, follow the link from www.kereport.com. The Corlin Economics Report will be back after this brief timeout.